The talk is what is left. Start with a small game taken from some scientists, but it's not like a scary scientific experiment. It's a game suggested by a scientist who was trying to describe how physicists now see reality, which is different from how we were taught when I was growing up. I remember the new physics when I was growing up was interesting, and it seemed like they didn't really know what they were talking about, and also that there seemed to be new discoveries coming all the time. And I asked my physics teacher one time, don't you think that they might come with another new discovery any time now? And he said, no. This is it. And what they see now by observing nature, which includes us, is that there's not much that we could say that it's fixed. So we'll play the game to see how it goes. We have a game where I grew up in the States called 21 Questions. Do you have that game here? You can also call it Animal, Mineral, Vegetable. So maybe we won't do 21 questions, but let's do 10 to start with. So one by one, you can ask a question with a yes or no answer. And usually the first question to start with has something to do with finding out whether what I'm thinking of is an animal, mineral, or vegetable. And by asking more and more questions, each time more specific, we eventually find out what I'm thinking of. So let's try. I hope I can manage. My part is harder than it sounds so far. Okay, who would like to ask? You can raise your hand so we're not yelling at the same time.
Are you an animal?
No. Yes.
Are you a vegetable?
Yes. Wait, we do hands. Yes. Are you edible? Okay. Yes. Four questions. Yes.
Are you green?
Yes. Five questions. Are you green? Yes.
An orange?
No. Yes. I said no to orange. No. Six. Not that I know of. No. Did you eat me this week? Not that I know of. It's something that I'm thinking of, by the way, not meat. Yes. Does it grow in a tree? No.
Are you watermelon?
No. Watermelon, no.
Are you hard?
Am I hard? No. Ten. Yes. Do you have to peel me to eat me? No. Yes.
Cucumber?
No.
Do you grow on the land?
Do I grow on the land? No.
Is it a pod?
Is it a pod? No. Three more questions.
Do you have leaves?
Do I have leaves? No.
Does the answer depend on the question or...
Nothing here. Okay. So usually I would need to decide first what I'm thinking of and answer according to that. But the scientist is saying there's not an answer to start with, but it depends on the questions as we go along. So that's why it's harder for me to figure out where we're going. Eventually I started to think of algae, some kind of algae or something. So the idea is that not just as a game, but actually reality, what we call real life reality, is this kind of game. Where depending on how we filter reality, depending on the questions that we ask, we get something different. What we perceive, what we experience is different. It's actually different experience. So if we like games, then There's a lot to play with here. There's a lot of going on, according to the scientists. Even more potential than all of the abundance of what we are aware of experiencing. So I'd like to tell another little story to just shake up our sense that we are very clear about experiencing reality, that we know we're experiencing reality. Especially when we say, oh, here we are on retreat, it's so unreal. But what about real life? What about when I get back to my real life? That's one perspective. Another perspective among many would be, sometimes we're touching things here that are more real than how we live our so-called real life. So another real story that happened several hundred years ago. So if we imagine that we are living on an island in the Caribbean, in the sea, and among us there are some shamans, there are some wise, powerful people. And one day, at least one of the shamans notices something happening in the sea. Something really weird is happening in the sea. There's some effect going on in the water that doesn't make sense. So I think that it would be safe to say probably every day here, each one of us has felt something similar. There's something that I'm experiencing that doesn't quite fit, doesn't make sense. But the shaman, unlike you and me, really got caught and interested and just kept staring at this thing that he was seeing in the water, this effect, for a really long time, looking. Because of being so interested, there's something that doesn't make sense to me from how I see things. This doesn't make sense. For us, it could be, who is breathing me? Or who decides what mood I wake up in the morning with? Or why I hate that person and I'm in love with that person. Can't wait to tell them after the retreat how many children we're going to have. So the shaman was staring at the water and eventually was able to see something that none of us Caribbean people, none of us had been able to see. And they were the ships of Columbus coming. The first time they'd seen a ship, they didn't see it. They didn't see the ship. They noticed something going on in the water. Looking. Ship. I'm interested in a question that someone raised in a group yesterday of what helps that shift to the ship. What is it that actually helps the shift? That we can actually see what is there that we didn't see. That we can actually take those little clues as actually interesting enough. Maybe about to have a huge impact on me. Feel is the most important factor in helping this kind of shift to happen. Is a word that is so overused it doesn't make sense anymore, but I use it anyway. And that is love. And I'd like to just play around with the possibility that this huge potential that the scientists, the physicists are talking about, this potential out of which our way of perceiving draws out something specific, if that potential has something to do with love. might remember in our lives. It has definitely happened, but we often don't remember. A time that we were without demand. We were not feeling demands. We were not feeling pressure. And we were also not operating out of demand with demand. With a feeling, I don't have enough, and I have to go out and get it. That was not happening. Another way to describe what I mean by love. Not a very big love. But that doesn't exclude all of the specific experiences that we have, the specific perceptions that we draw out of the potential by our looking, by our point of view, by our filtering. Times we might have been able to see a person or a frog or a ray of light. Someone came up to me the other day, just here. I was walking to my room, and she said, I just have to tell someone this, and I happened to be lucky enough to be walking by. She said, for the first time in my life, I saw, and she said, I'm not sure how you say it in English, that thing that comes from the sun. And that was it. She's like, bye. I was like, that's great. Great. Sometimes we can be so clearly with the specific perception that we see the vastness out of which that specific comes. We see a hand that is not an eternal hand. It's not the only correct hand. It's not the archetypal hand. It's not the hand of the ultimate, if that ultimate only has one hand. Sometimes we're just shocked by the vastness in that hand. It's shocking. It would be easier to be struck by lightning. So we don't look. Practices actually say that everything, including whether it's my body or this table or this plastic sort of carpet, actually mostly potential. Unformed. Unless it's formed for me by my way of looking, by my way of feeling, smelling, thinking, etc. I love this love that feels like so much to share with you. And I love this love that's also in so many books from people throughout the ages and throughout the cultures. And one of my favorite books, there's a passage that I find really helpful here. As with many of my favorite books, many of the great teachings, it's just simply a conversation between a student and a teacher. So again, the teacher maybe has access to vastness, to touching into the potential behind. And by the student's question, some words come out that can be helpful. So this student said, I have heard people say, so when you start like that, it's good that there's a question coming instead of a statement. I've heard and people say that this world is unreal. And I don't understand. I don't understand what they mean. It's not true. that the world is unreal. It's the way that we relate to the world, the way that we filter the world. And an important part of how we filter the world is as my world, separate from me. Is as a world that is either a threat or something that I need to use for my separate benefit. What a limited place to sit. So it can be helpful to wonder if this teacher had something important to say. Maybe it's not that the world is unreal, and I just have to kind of dissolve into the nothingness. Maybe not that. Maybe it's the filtering. Maybe it's the way I approach the world. That is, in the sense of unnecessary, unhelpful. Inside us, so that we could feel how we filter. Do we filter? These filters are usually demands on our experience, on the world. These filters that someone is suggesting are unreal, unnecessary, unhelpful. The way I see you and I going about living. All of that potential is too much for me. To say the same. Somewhere we are aware, we realize the fact of our vulnerability. The fact of our being so exposed. The other animals have shells and fur and sharp claws. They're also exposed. But look at us. Also being exposed, another way to say so much is to say so much openness. Which sometimes feels scary. It means anything could happen. And sitting right here, knowing what is 5 kilometers away, it becomes a very real sensation that anything could happen. We don't have to convince ourselves about that. In other countries, we have to kind of imagine, what would it be like to really know that anything could happen? Here, maybe we need to include in that anything not just a bomb, but also things that are not considered negative. Also a smile or an understanding. Anything. So we feel it's too much. And we try to back up from our actual seat of vulnerability. Do you feel the power of the vulnerability also? It's not just that a bomb could come. That as a human being, freedom could happen at any time. We could have not just an attack of restlessness, but as mentioned to someone a few days ago, it looked like an attack of honesty had happened. And I feel like there's a lot of attacks of honesty going on in this room. And that's why today I feel like sharing some of my most treasured things. I was just laughing to myself in the beautiful silence before I broke it with this talk. One of those silly little thoughts that comes. The words Charlie's Angels came to my mind. I don't know. Do you have that in Israel at all? Okay. Sorry about that. And I was thinking of this coincidence that the five teachers are all female. And how we sometimes have a sense or we get a note. Someone's having an attack of sadness over by the dining hall. I've got it. Someone's having an attack of insight over there. All right. Got my Kleenex for this one. Distance from our actual situation of vulnerability. A vulnerability that includes not really knowing. Actual, true place of vulnerability starts to look like something that's not quite enough. So on an emotional level, we have all felt that not enoughness, needing something which might be a meditative experience, or it might be a sexual experience, or it might be a food experience, or it might be anything. On a more subtle level, when we start to tune into, for example, what is this body, it turns out that we find out there's not that much to go on. It's not a solid experience. So we get even more freaked out. Everybody else has a solid body. What happened to mine? I better pretend that I've got it together. And then once we start pretending, the immediate effect is, so like the ship in the water, the effect to look for, demand. Sometimes on retreats we get notes that say, I would like to make a request. And I started to think maybe I had forgotten my English after all these years of trying to speak Spanish and Hindi. I thought a request was like, please, would it be possible? Instead of, if you don't, I'm going to something. Even demand, and we do even demand, from our practice in meditation. And we try to make a bargain. All right, if you work by this evening, I'll keep you. And if you don't behave yourself and start working by this evening, you're out of here. I'm going to go do an Osho thing. And I'd like to talk a little bit about technique in meditation and what its place is, what its role is, or function. Technique is to start with, to get us started, when we're not already started by a sense of wonder or shock or seeing something in the water that doesn't make sense. Started so that we start to get to know a little bit our territory. What is the mind? What is a thought? It's not that now we know what a thought is, I'm pretty sure. But we've at least tried to feel and to notice. We might have noticed that thought could come as image or word or shape. So we've noticed a little bit more finely these fairly subtle areas. It's the 21 questions game. And we need to play the game. We need to leave the work with the technique that we're trying to force it to work. We're demanding that it will work in the way that we want and expect by such and such time and place and date. And then we need to go to that animal, mineral, vegetable thing. So when we're trying to find our way, our path, our own way, not the adopted technique, we're not trying to find an object that pre-exists. We're just feeling, out of all the potential questions I could ask, what question seems to be important? What question lights up? What area lights up? If you love the heart meditation, that might be a way of saying, that area is lighting up, go into it. For example, I'd like to tell one of my favorite stories that's also what we call a real story, a true story. And it's also a story that symbolizes, for me, finding our way. Some clues about what happens when we're asking the 5th and 10th and 15th question. We're finding our way. Once upon a time, in the real world, there was a teenage guy who happened to be autistic, who happened to live in Australia, who happened to live in a boarding school, who happened to not make eye contact with people, who happened to be placed in a class that was called the low functioning class. So this is what we tend to do with ourselves. We identify what seems to be not making contact, what seems to be scarily unwelcome in society, and we find a boarding school and send it there. And we send it to the low functioning class, which might turn out in the long run to be a good thing, because in the low functioning class there's not much supervision, there's not much expectation. The leaders of the school are not looking for great results from the low-functioning class. So we could feel our Charlie's Angels behind the scenes, feeling the great potential going on in our low-functioning class, in the one that doesn't make eye contact, doesn't speak, has never spoken, except once. Happened to need to fulfill some kind of social service hours for her yoga ashram. And she happened to end up, as she puts it very appropriately, in the low functioning class. When the directors of the school met her, they thought, that's a good match. As she tells the story anyway. And she was given a kind of program that she was supposed to go through with her students, which she tried to do. That's like when you get here and we say, be open. Or just follow the breath. So simple. Just reading the syllabus, reading out what she was supposed to read out. No one paying any attention to her. And luckily, she got how we get, which is either desperate or hopeless, or crazy enough to try something different. And so she started to read out to the class her favorite yoga text. As soon as she started, she read the first line. The teenage guy, who never looked at anyone, looked at her. She was his ship. I think I'm going to read another line. And she did. And he looked at her more. A small moment in the lives of two people that I find very touching. And I find that we have that moment, the potential for that moment, many times a day. And to emphasize the importance of this moment, I'm going to bring out the Buddha. I'm going to tell a story about the Buddha. So that we really could maybe feel how important this moment is, where we drop the program that the leaders gave us, but we don't just abandon the class. So it's not like after the army going to Goa or Sinai or whatever. We're not just looking for relief from all of the pain and pressure. Some relief, yes, but not only that. There's one kind of pleasure that happens when we just get relief from our belief that we're not enough. We get relief from our need that we think we must be special. We get relief from our feeling lack, not enough. In our very specific ways. For some people, chocolate does it for a few seconds. For other people, a quiet meditation does it. We feel, I'm okay after all. Another kind of pleasure that the Buddha talks about. The Buddha was told by his teachers that the best way to enlightenment, to higher states, to superhuman states, as it's written in the text that we have, and just to remember that the texts that we have were written down a long time after the Buddha lived. So the poor Buddha, who knows what he was really like. But it's a good story anyway. Especially this one. Especially because the Buddha is so well known as someone who is encouraging suffering. Such a strange thing, when what he was talking about was freedom from suffering. Buddhist monk, and we think, if I would be a Buddhist monk, I can really take the suffering. I could really handle it. So the Buddha did all of these painful practices, mostly holding his breath. And I must say, I personally find that the Buddha has an excellent sense of humor. And when he's describing these practices, I find that the humor is there, at least for me. And if you just think about the Buddha, whoa, the high human being, the enlightened one, he's not enlightened yet. Holding his breath for as long as he can. And it's painful, and he describes the painfulness like a Monty Python movie, if you've ever seen Monty Python. He felt as if a leather strap was being pulled really, really tightly on his head. And a lot of other things that I won't bother you with so that you don't have terrible Buddha fantasies. Because in the end, he kept trying and doing it longer and harder, having more and more pain. And finally he said, all right, that's it. No one ever, I think he was exaggerating a little bit, but he said, no one ever, he said, ever in the past, ever in the future, and ever now, anywhere, ever felt this much pain. Ever, he said. And I didn't get any superhuman states out of it. I'm not enlightened. And it's also desperate and hopeless. And we could feel that moment happening to us, especially today for many people. I tried the hardest thing ever, and it didn't work. I'm in the most difficulty ever, and I don't see any way out. Ever. One of my teachers talks about the possibility of hopelessness as a way, which can sound really depressing. It can sound like a good trick that we could try to play, but it doesn't work that way. Maybe if I pretend to be really hopeless, then all of this suffering will go away. It doesn't work. Hopeless means I'm so tired of trying to make demands. And on top of that, I'm so tired and it didn't work. I still feel not enough. Luckily, a thought came to the Buddha's mind. We think thoughts are the enemy. But luckily, a thought came to the Buddha's mind. Maybe there's another way. And then, although for us it might take another year before we say, there is another way. According to the story, he says, maybe there's another way. And then another thought, a memory even, oh my God, from the past, comes up. A memory from the past comes up and shows another way. A memory from childhood comes up and gives a flavor of another way. So being open to these visits. He remembered a time where he was relaxed under a tree, watching his father plow the field, working the field. And as you can imagine, he wasn't that interested in watching his father plow the field. But he wasn't bothered by it either. And somehow it happened that he felt a different kind of pleasure. Not a pleasure that comes by demanding it or pretending it. Not a pleasure that comes by reaching out and trying to fill. Not a pleasure that comes from feeling I must be special. What proves to me that I'm special? A different kind of pleasure, and he uses the word pleasure. And, like us, when we remember those moments of that kind of pleasure, we get a little nervous. We don't trust ourselves with pleasure. We've seen ourselves addicted to so many things, even being nice, being good, being helpful. So we get pretty nervous when we experience or remember this other kind of pleasure that just comes out of nowhere. It comes not because I stimulated it or squeezed it out of my experience. It's a kind of feeling like when we're lying and resting or trying to rest. And sometimes we suggest, have the feeling that your eyes fall into the back of your head, which could sound like another weird Buddha Monty Python thing to do. But sometimes we have that feeling of even the eyes are resting back. They're not alert to what might happen next. And there can open out another kind of pressure. It doesn't mean that the thoughts stop. We need to pay attention here. We need to give value to this moment. So the Buddha said, maybe that is a way to enlightenment, through that other kind of pressure. And then he said, why am I afraid of that pleasure? So we're not alone when we get nervous. And then, if only we could be so quick, he said, why am I afraid of that pleasure? I am not afraid of that pleasure. And we could hear that voice in many different ways, but I like that. I'm not afraid of that pleasure. Instead of like, I'm not afraid of my pleasure. Not trying to convince ourselves, but being taken by it. My friend in Australia, the story with the Buddha, this kind of moment of shifting, where it's not like exactly shifting from one gear to the next gear. It's like shifting out of gear and then being taken. We've given up on the gears. We're tired. We can't get it into gear again. And then we find ourselves being moved. Out of gear. There's a lot of space and a lot of potential again. Coincidences start being noticeable. And not only negative coincidences. Oh yeah, what happened? By chance, it so happened that someone came to that school with a new technology using a keyboard for people that couldn't use their throats to speak but could use their hands to type, to communicate. And this is what happens inwardly for us. We give up, or we say, I like that other kind of pleasure. And we shift. It's another way to say it is we start to trust our own love, even though it's so big and so exact and so demanding of us, instead of my being demanding of it. Pleasure. Maybe that's the way. That is the way. Why am I afraid of that way? I'm not afraid of that way. So a woman came to share this technology in the school, and Kavita had just realized that there was a lot more happening in this low-functioning room with this one teenage man. And so she immediately got the woman with the keyboard to work with him, to teach him how to type. And soon enough, as soon as he could type, in fact, very soon, they had to get out the dictionary to understand the words he was using. More and more trust developed, as it does inwardly with us, with that part that we put away in the low-functioning class, with that part that we didn't expect anything from, and that might be a key. We start to get communication back from that completely unaggressive place, that quiet, unspeaking place. That place that's not trying at all to get my attention. In that communication, we get blown away by the wisdom that comes through. This teenage man told my friend all about various controversies that were happening secretly in her yoga school, for example, that in a few months came out in the newspaper. Mind-blowing. Another thing that happens when we start to get feeling back in that quiet place, because we start to find the way to communicate and the way to listen. The other main thing that happens is we hear our own pain. We stop listening to the stories that are just a distraction from the real pain. Today in the group, it was very lovely to hear one person having nightmares, and then before going to sleep, welcoming, okay, nightmares, welcome. Please come tonight. I'll meet you there. And no one came, as she said, beautifully. But another kind of welcome, a little bit open, a little bit welcoming, being aware of pain that seemed not to be there before. We might have seen some movement in the water that didn't make sense, but we didn't see anything there. This young man was finally able to tell someone why he was in this boarding school. So his whole life growing up, himself unable to speak, but able to listen and to see. And his father violent with his mother. One day, it so happened that this young man managed to say two words out of desperation to his father. He said, "You," and he said, "Animal." And that's why he was in the boarding school. So by communication with the parts that we think are unable to communicate, by being able to listen to our own pain, the real pain, things happen. It's not just one result. Many healings happen, not just one. His mother helped for his father, helped for him, helped for us. Not a kind of help that is imposing on us. A help that seems to happen by coincidence, like the keyboard happened to come after, not before, Kavita realized that she could communicate. My friend, Kavita. Many times when we start to get the sensitivity back, and it's not just great insights coming, we again think there's something wrong. So much pain. Too much pain. This is a different kind of pain, like we have a different kind of pleasure. It's like the pain when my leg has fallen asleep, and then I get the circulation back, and it hurts. And I could say, oh, I better go back and sit cross-legged for the rest of my life. which we wouldn't do to our body, but we do to our inward self. I better just bend it back in there. Where we especially need each other, not to fix anything. We especially need each other, though. Just finding a way of communicating, just listening. And sometimes just doing what must be done. Like finding the mother. Letting the mother and her son meet again more often. But it's important how we go about doing what must be done. And there's another great story that happened to my friend with this young man. So the whole school realized that this was not exactly a low-functioning class. My friend got to stay with them as their so-called teacher. This young man understood the yoga text that she was reading. He was just surprised that he wasn't the only one that had ever experienced these things. But still, conventionally we can say Kavita, my friend, was the teacher of the class. And it was the last class before the holiday break. And it happened to be what they call workshop time, which I wish I knew exactly what they had in there, but I imagine like wooden blocks and stuff to build things with, maybe some paper, glue. People were all over the place doing their creative things, and my friend Kavita was running from one corner to the next, trying to quiet people down, keep them from getting into a fight over the scissors or whatever. This happens to us inside, too. We're running around trying to quiet it down here. This gets quiet, and then three places over there. Which one is more dangerous? Should I go to first? We run to the next one. Five more pop up as soon as that one's quiet. So she was running around and running around, like we do. And she gave up, like we do, eventually. And just as she gave up, just as she got hopeless, she saw this young man sitting quietly next to the wall. And she went over to him, like we do. And he typed out, "Finally, I've been trying to get your attention for an hour." Just be quiet. Sit down next to me and be quiet. Take a deep breath. Relax. The room went quiet. The whole room went quiet. Trying inside us. When we're relating to all of these things that are popping up, that we're trying our best, we're really trying our best to bring harmony to it. But we're running. We're trying to fix it. Alone responsibility. I'm the only teacher in this room. I've got to get this room quiet before someone hurts someone else or herself or himself. We feel so much responsibility that we even lose track of how much we care and how much the caring knows about just sit down next to me and be quiet. And letting go of trying so hard, trying our best. And just coming to the place where it's potential. Anything is possible. I don't need to be special. the special one who has to get the room quiet before someone sees me. So chaotic. We fall into the silence in which sounds are happening. We fall into something that is very, we could say, special, but that does not come through me when I need to be special. It does come through me in every other way. Just another statement that is supposed to be from the Buddha that could be worth chewing on. A wise person doesn't rate herself or himself, doesn't rank, doesn't say, I'm as good as the best people. It doesn't say the worst people, I'm the worst. It just doesn't bother with that. And even more so, it doesn't even bother saying, I'm like everyone, I'm like the medium. It doesn't bother rating herself or himself in any way. Got so tired of doing that. Finally noticed that it didn't make sense. Something else was going on, more important. Out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Soul lies down in that grass. The world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the words each other just don't make any sense.